Welcome to a special podcast of the Eastern American Diocese. Today's podcast is a lecture by Protodeacon Serge Arlievsky entitled Consequences of the 1917 Revolution, Russians in the Lower Hudson Valley. This lecture was recorded on December 23, 2017, at the St. Herman's Youth Conference, which was hosted by Holy Dormition Convent, Novodeveyevo.
Russians in the Lower Hudson Valley. We have two churches in the Lower Hudson Valley. We have the convent, Novodeveyevo, the women's monastery. We also have the Nyack Parish, which is very close by. So why do we have these onion domes with Orthodox crosses in the middle of New York? So to answer that question, their histories are actually very related. But it's not really even just the histories of the places and why we're here that's important. Some people say it's perhaps because of the scenery. Russia has a lot of rivers. The Hudson River may have brought people in. People started settling here. Priests started coming here after World War II for the most part. And the communities settled down. And of course, our parents, for the most part, all gathered around the church. So what is it that we need to do? I think I'm going to try to take you on a journey through time. And this journey starts in the 12th century. Goes through the 17, 1800s, and then comes up to World War I and the tragic events of 1905, 1917, and then the last 100 years, which was also tragic in many ways. We will be looking at various objects that we consider important, and we will also be looking at several people, Father Seraphim Slobodskoy, who founded the Nyack Parish, and Archbishop Andrei, who founded the Novodeveyevo Convent. So, as we begin, there are four objects here which we have in Novodeveyevo. One of them is not resident at Novodeveyevo, the Kursk root icon of the Mother of God, but she will be with us tonight. We also have a Vladimir icon, which belonged to the Optina elders. We have a portrait of St. Seraphim that was said to be painted during his lifetime. And then we have a cross by the table for the departed, which was in the Ipatievsky Dom, in the house where the royal martyrs were murdered. So that is also something of significance. And then we have Father Adrian Rybarenko, who later became Bishop Andrei, and Father Seraphim Slobodskoy. So, starting with the Kursk icon of the Mother of God, this is one of the most famous icons throughout Russian history. In Kursk now, as in the past, on processions, you can gather tens of thousands of people that will come to walk with this icon. Most of those tens of thousands don't even see the icon, but they still walk and they pray to the Mother of God, and they believe that the Mother of God will give them her protection and her guidance. And then these same people will stand in line for hours. And Apian also made a painting of this particular procession with the Mother of God, the Kursk icon. People will stand for hours just to spend several seconds venerating the icon, and then they move on to allow the other people come through. So this icon has a very interesting history, and she will be with us tonight. And so I wanted all of us, even those who know about the icon, to really understand how significant it is that she can be with us at our church service, and we can pray in front of it when the rest of the world doesn't always have that opportunity. We also have this portrait of St. Seraphim, which was originally kept in the Deveva convent and eventually made it into Vladyka Andrei's hands. We also have a Vladimir icon of the Mother of God, which belonged to first St. Ambrose, the Optina elder, and then St. Nectarius when St. Ambrose reposed in the Lord. So that is also something that we will discuss. And then, as I said, Ipatievsky Dom, the Kriest from the house of the engineer Ipatiev, where the royal martyrs were martyred. We have Father Seraphim Slobodskoy, who we'll be speaking with. His claim to fame was writing the Law of God text that almost everybody, not just in the diaspora, but people in Russia, when the communism was there, that book was smuggled in various forms, reprinted in various forms, and millions of copies were distributed illegally so that people thirsting for knowledge of their faith could have something. And then we will discuss Bishop Andre, Father Proto-Presbyter Adrian Rymenko in this picture, Archbishop Andre in this picture. And he had a very real tie to the Optina elders. When he became a priest in very trying circumstances, he traveled and met with Elder Anatoly at first, and then when he passed away with Elder Nectarius. And they set him on a course that basically controlled his life as far as a priest. And so he is a direct descendant, you could say, of the Optina elders. So these objects and these people are what we're going to talk about. So let's begin our journey. We're going to start in the 13th century. In the 1200s, we had... Kursk is one of the oldest cities in Russia. But in the 13th century, during the terrible Tatar invasions, the province of Kursk was devastated. The city became devoid of people, basically wiped off the face of the earth. Kursk was devastated, and it became a forest wilderness. We've all heard how from the city of Rilsk, which was nearby, hunters used to come to the forest to hunt because there were no people there, just animals. And one of them found an icon lying face down. This slide is from 3 comments ago. You can see not only Kursk was devastated, but most of Russia at that point. The hunter found the icon lying face down. When he picked it up, a stream of water, clear, clean spring water, came from the ground. And that stream continues to this very day, has never stopped, which is quite interesting. And so the hunter then built a small chapel for the icon at the tree, and the residents of Rilsk came to the icon with faith and reverence, and their prayers were answered with miracles. So we also heard how these people in Rilsk who revered that icon took it to their city, away from the forest, but somehow the icon would disappear at night, and the next morning they would find it back in its original spot. And they kept doing this until they realized the Mother of God wants her icon there. And so they would come to her, and their prayers would be answered. So very quickly on, this icon received became famous amongst the local people and eventually spread throughout all of Russia. And this icon participated in many important events in Russian history. Then we also, many of us know how in 1383, the Tatars invaded the province again and cleaved the icon in two, took the priest Bogolyub prisoner, and Bogolyub, God lover, literal translation, after being ransomed from captivity, how he came back and found the two halves that had been thrown apart, brought them together, and they miraculously melded back together. And you can still see on the back of the icon, you can still see marks of where that break was, but it's one solid piece, another miracle. So how then over the next 200 years, this icon of the Mother of God grew in fame, continuous miracles and answers to prayers. So consider yourselves very, very lucky today at the church service when we can stand there for the entire service and pray in front of this icon. So we're at 1383, let's jump to 1597. Tsar Fyodor Ivanovich of Moscow was wondering, why do we refer to this icon? Why do we call it the Kursk root icon when Kursk doesn't exist? There is no Kursk city. It was never rebuilt. It was destroyed. So he rebuilt the city. And not only did he rebuild the city, but he decorated the icon. And he built a monastery on that spot, which is the Hermitage. And this is the Church of the Spring, which is located inside the church now over here. And then the water also flows out to the river that's on the side. He also had the icon, and this is just the interior view of that church. It's very interesting. This is one large corridor with stairs. So here you are standing at the top of stairs looking down at the... So anybody, you can pack a lot of people in there, and everybody can see the royal doors. Originally, the icon was just this size. Tsar Fyodor added the prophets around the edge who were prophetizing of the coming of Christ through the Mother of God, through the Virgin Mary. Also made a silver riza for the icon, and then had it brought back to Kursk. This is probably not that original silver one. This photograph is from the beginning of the 20th century. So it's probably a new reason here, but you get the idea. In 1760, a young Seraphim Sarov, who was still not Monk Seraphim, just a child Prokhor, was very, very ill, and the icon was coming through his procession, and a sudden rainstorm started where they had to run inside. They just happened to run inside into the building where Seraphim was sick, and the icon healed him. So the icon that we will be praying in front of today healed Saint Seraphim of Sarov. So in 1893, the future Archbishop Andrei is born, Adrian Adrianovich Rimarenko. That includes the Archbishop's Andrei's address at becoming a bishop. I'm just going to read a few lines from there. I grew up in a pious family. I was surrounded by that Orthodox way of life which generations have been created by Holy Russia. Our family was well off, and the religious outlook which penetrated our life, we had to reflect indeed. We participated in the building of churches. We set out tables with food for the poor. We sent donations to prisons, hospitals. Of course, there were sorrows and illness and deaths, but they too were accepted in the light of Christ. The awareness that Christ is risen and the life of man will be in the resurrection of Christ helped us to bear our misfortunes and adversities. Everything was experienced with ease and joyfulness. We felt a kind of extraordinary inspiration, a kind of quiet joy. This quiet joy, which Archbishop Andrew is talking about, is what drove him his entire life. And that was what he experienced as a child, and that is what he was looking for. So he was experiencing quiet, calm, and joy, but at this time, there really, the revolution was brewing, and there were, for quite a while, things were unsettling in Russia. 1898, anarchists placed a time bomb in the Cathedral of the Sign to destroy the Kursk root icon. And what's very interesting is the explosion was at 2 a.m., a horrible scene of devastation. The force of the blast shattered the canopy over the icon. The heavy marble base was split into several pieces. A huge candlestick had been blown to the other side of the cathedral. A cast iron door had been torn off its hinges. All the windows in the cathedral, even in the large dome up above, had been shattered. The holy icon remained unharmed, and even the glass within the frame remained whole. And what's interesting, in 1949 in Frankfurt, Germany, and when the icon was there after World War II, an old man who was standing in the back of the church approached the priest who happened to be there. He confessed to taking part in the bombing. He said he was a helper of the main culprit, and he was just a young kid. He didn't believe in God. He decided to put it to the test. If God exists, he won't allow the icon to be harmed. And then he added to that, not a day goes by where I do not with tears ask God for forgiveness for my terrible act. And he stood in the back of the church, didn't walk up to the icon because he felt himself unworthy, did a prostration, and left. So even people who do terrible things, sometimes God brings them around with the help of miracle-working icons. So now, in 1912, Seraphim Slobodskoy is born. He was a son of a priest, Alexei, Father Alexei, and Matushka Vera. Because he was a son of a priest, and at the time of the 1917 revolution, he was only 5 years old, he experienced a lot of hardship. As a son of a priest, he was made fun of. They had no advancement. He wanted to be an artist. He was never accepted into any art schools. In World War II, when he finally, he was forced into conscription, into the army, he was considered the undesirables, a priest's son. He was sent out to walk in front to see if there's any landmines. That's how they checked. They would send the priest's sons out. And somehow, he survived intact, never got harmed, and God protected him. As a young child, and in 1917, when the revolution happened, Adrian Rybarenko was also 24 years old. So he was a bit older, and he had begun to going to a polytechnic school. He had a promising career in front of him. But something was missing from his life. That quietness that he experienced in childhood, he couldn't live without. So in October 14th, which is the Feast Day of Pokrov, in 1921, which is right in the middle of the biggest persecutions of the Russian church, he decides to become a priest. Ordained a deacon, 3 days later he's ordained a priest. Father Adrian then began to travel to Optina, first with the elder Anatoly and then with elder Nectarius. When he couldn't make it to Optina, he would send his matushka with a whole list of questions and things, and Father Nectari would answer to him. So he, for this decade of the 1920s, he received a lot of experience from Optina. And in 1923, Optina was closed by the communists, and Father Nectari was sent into exile. They still managed to somehow communicate with him and to keep contact until Father Nectari passed away in 1928. In 1926, the church where Father Adrian was serving was closed, and he was sent to Kiev where he could be kept under closer surveillance. In 1927, the Diveva convent was closed, and the nuns were sent apart. So the significance of that is, for us, over here, the Optina icon of the Mother of God was saved by somebody out of a pile that was thrown in rubbish and eventually brought over to Father Adrian and given to him for safekeeping. And eventually, we'll see later on, the icon of the portrait of Saint Seraphim also made its way to Father Adrian. So in the 1930s, this is Father Adrian's quote, "There began the frightful time of the reveling of the atheists. In the heat of persecutions against the church and believers, of massive arrests and executions." We all know that in the 1930s, but this is the life he lived. He was a priest, he was hiding, he was serving the liturgy as often as he could, and he was being arrested. We don't know how many times he was arrested. And there were times where he was arrested and sentenced to death. There's one particular time, he was at a prosecutor who sentenced everybody to death. So he did the same with Father Adrian. Father Adrian was about to be brought out to the firing squad when all of a sudden another prosecutor walked in and arrested the prosecutor. And they took him away. And they looked at Father Adrian and said, "Why are you standing here? Get out, go." And so he left. And there were other times where he answered to the prosecutor, "What would your grandmother say that you're sentencing me to death?" And on that particular person, it had an effect. So we don't know how many times he was in jail and came out. He hasn't specified, that we know of, but it was probably more than one. In 1937, in one particular night in Kiev, almost all of the priests were arrested. Father Adrian wasn't arrested because the family he lived with, he knew that if they came at night and arrested him, they would probably be arrested as well. So at night, he was hiding during the day, and at night he would climb out of the window and go a little bit further out and hug a tree and hold on to the tree so that as he falls asleep, he doesn't fall down. And that's how we would spend the night and then climb back into the window during the day. This is the life that a priest had to live in order to survive in the Soviet Union. And it's important because this comes to play later on when the German invaders come in. The war came. The Germans occupied Kiev. And Father Adrian says, churches were opened. People starved for the Orthodox way of life streamed into churches. And this highlights the big difference between what the Nazis did and what the Soviets did. Yes, the Nazis, they came in. The German forces did a lot of atrocities. There was a lot of terror campaigns that they did as well. But the Soviet system didn't just try to suppress religion. It tried to drive it out of you. And they just kept going at it until they would break the person. And they would use whatever tactics, the terror tactics, that they felt like. And so when the Germans came and they opened churches, we have an assistant here. There's an article, a very nice article that was written about Bishop Andrei in a local paper when he had just become archbishop, and his lifelong helper, Dmitry Vladimirovich Myshetsky, is quoted as saying, "Germans were worse than the communists, but when the communists began advancing, We were afraid to get caught again behind the Iron Curtain and lose our last chance to escape westward. So yes, perhaps the Germans were worse, but they allowed you to go to church. They allowed you to perform the liturgy. They allowed you to take communion. To understand what was the spiritual state, one had only to attend church, especially on Nativity or Pascha, to see the crowds of thousands gathered, overflowing from the churches into the streets. This was a quote from Father Adrian at the time. So his experience was completely different than Father Seraphim Slabatskoy's. So in 1943, he had to evacuate again to Berlin. As the Soviets were advancing and were going to take over Kiev again, the German authorities offered Father Adrian to leave with his family and go with them. So Father Adrian gave them a list of his 100 family members on the list that he gave them, that these are the essential people that should go with me. And they allowed all of them to leave. So when Father Adrian came to Berlin, he was then appointed as the rector of the Berlin Cathedral that we had there. And the Germans caused a few problems, but they still managed to have daily liturgies. They would hide from the bombing raids, from the Allied bombing raids. This portrait was then brought to Berlin and given to Father Adrian for safekeeping, knowing that he revered Saint Seraphim. And what's interesting about this portrait is it was kept inside the side altar. As one night after a particular bombing raid, when they were returning back to the church, they saw smoke and flames ran into the church. The altar was on fire on the left. A bomb had fallen through the ceiling and had incendiary bond caused the fire. It hadn't exploded, but it caused the fire. This portrait was burning, a cross was burning, and there was another icon that was burning. They put out the fire, picked up the icon, and the only damage on this icon, and I tried to lighten this next picture up a little bit, you can see this hole over here. And when we walk up to the icon later on today, before the church service, we'll open up the small chapel where this is kept and we can reverence this icon, you'll be able to see that damage. That's the only damage that occurred from the flames that had engulfed the entire icon. So they ended up, from Berlin, they ended up evacuating out to a small town called Wendlingen. And there they also established daily church services. They would take communion every day, they would have liturgy every day. And it's just so happened that they were at an inn at the time. There's about 40 people with Vladyka. And he had had a dream that he didn't quite understand. He saw himself in vestments carrying the icon of the Mother of God over his head, and he couldn't understand why would he be doing that. The tanks came in, the Americans and the Germans faced off and started shooting at each other in down the streets next to the inn where they were. This isn't an actual picture of that, it's just a reenactment. But you can see how it would be, narrow streets, you're in one of these inns, the tanks are shooting at each other, there's a battle going on. Their inn was hit. The innkeeper rushed in and said, the building's on fire, you have to leave, we have to leave, we're all gonna die. Everybody started panicking, and Vladyka remembered his dream. So he picked up the icon, put on his epitrachelion, or his vestments, I'm not sure which, might have been just one or the other, the descriptions don't quite specify, picked up the icon and walked outside. And the people that were with him followed. What else are you gonna do? The tanks, can you imagine their bewilderment? Seeing a priest in vestments walking out into the middle of the crossfire. So the Germans stopped firing. And then the Americans stopped firing. And for almost 2 whole minutes, while this little ragtag group made it down the street and around the corner into a little park, so where the trees were, they waited. And as soon as they were out of the range, the tank battle resumed. So ever since then, when Vladyka came to America, he was serving daily akafists to this particular icon for having saved them from that time. One thing I forgot to mention, when the St. Seraphim portrait was burning from the bomb, the next morning they went back to the church to have their liturgy, and the smell was worse. So they said, something's wrong. So they started looking, they went up into the attic of the cathedral. They found a second bomb. It had fallen through the roof, but it hadn't fallen all the way through, and it was sitting there smoldering. It had been smoldering for 12 hours. And as soon as they walked up to it, it caught fire. So they were able to easily put it out because it was just localized at that point. But had it caught fire 12 hours ago, the cathedral would have burned to the ground. And after that, and there are similar references to the Kursk icon. When the Kursk icon was in World War II and people were around it, the houses that the Kursk icon visited seemed not to be damaged by bombs for the most part. And the same thing here, after that incident, the carpet bombing that went on destroyed all the buildings around, but the cathedral stood. So now we could talk a little about Father Seraphim Slobodskoy. He, as an undesirable, was sent to the army. He was captured in 1942 and sent to a prisoner of war camp in Lithuania. So he spent a good 3 years in the prisoner of war camp. They had a life expectancy of about 6 months in that camp. And he survived 3 years. These are some sketches that he did as an artist. You can see this is called Nakazanya, the punishment. They're beating a prisoner. This is where they lived. Ludzie zhili v norach. A norka is where the fox lived, a hole in the ground where animals live. That's how they lived out in the open. There was no shelter because the only buildings that contained shelter were for the people that were sick, in an infirmary or dying, and people that weren't quite dying yet had to live outside. So they were very cruelly treated by the German people that had captured were guarding them. But in this camp, he actually met, this is Father Seraphim, when he's still Seraphim. This gentleman, I keep forgetting his name, but the three of them were friends. This is Nikolai Popkov. He's the father, he's the iconographer, he's the father of Father Andrei Popkov, many of us know. He painted the icons in Nyack and in Novodevichy. The three of them vowed that if they ever, this is taken in 1949, this picture, if they ever survive the prisoner of war camp, they'll get together and they will build a church. So Seraphim later became Father Seraphim. In 1951, became a priest in Germany. And in 1953, he emigrated to America and was assigned as the rector of the Nyack Parish. But before that, after the war, there were displaced nuns. After World War II, displaced nuns that needed to form a convent and needed to be placed somewhere. So the idea of a convent was started by Bishop Averki, I believe, and Bishop Nikon. And they thought about it, but nothing really happened until Father Adrian Rybarenko came to the United States in 1949 with his group of followers. And he had experience with convents in Kiev and other places, so they assigned to him the task of assembling a convent. We had nuns who were displaced in Europe, and Bishop John of Shanghai also had nuns from China who ended up in the Philippines that he sent over to here. So in the beginning, we had about 45 to 50 nuns that came together and formed the Novodevichy convent. So initially, when Father Adrian came to Nyack, this is called the Elephant House. That's where they had their services. It's a garage. But it's called the Elephant House for a reason. There was a millionaire who was eccentric, and he had an elephant. And this is the garage that he kept it in. Nyack wasn't a downtown area yet. It was still pretty much in the suburbs. And then the elephant was long gone, and they rented out the garage. The first services were here. This is now on the spot where the Nyack Middle School is. So the garage is long gone. There's probably a football field there at this time. I'm not really sure. But they started here. Then eventually they found a larger area, another house, where they actually hoped to stay with the nuns. But it was a little expensive, and the owner was not willing to sell at a lower price. So they started looking around, and Father Adrian was able to find the current location of Novodevichy now. It was a Catholic convent that had closed down for years. It was not being used, and they wanted it to be sold to somebody who would use it in a manner consistent with the way it had been used before. So all they needed was $30,000 to buy this land with buildings on it and a small chapel inside the house. I think these pictures are out of order, but this is Father Seraphim Slobodskoy when he was in Camp Nor in Lagin. He was a big sportsman. He liked to play soccer and I guess baseball is here. I don't think he's hitting the boys. I think he's hitting something that's being thrown in. We didn't really have chapels back then, so we either put up a tent or apparently Russians really like birch trees. And so we would create these structures out of birch trees and use them as a iconostas. But getting back to Father Adrian, here with his dog Tomka, I remember. They also, in Novodevichy, for the first service on the land where they would consecrate the cemetery, also built an iconostasis, a little bit bigger, out of birch trees, out of birch branches. Vladik Anastasi, the Metropolitan, was serving there. They didn't have any money. They had nothing. So how can they pay $30,000 to make it down? They needed a $5,000 down payment. And they were about to give up on the land when a gentleman who had saved up $5,000 for his retirement decided to give it to the convent so they could buy the land. And then he would just live there and they would take care of him. And a lot of the people that came with Vladika were older or frail or injured from the war. And so it was just natural that at Novodevichy, not only the nuns took care of people, but eventually started an old age home where they would take care of older people as a rule. And what do you do with the old people when they pass away? Well, you need a cemetery. So they started a cemetery. And now it's the largest cemetery that we have in North America. We have over 8,000 people buried there, probably more like 8,500 at this point. So then they decided we need a church. So they started building the church that we will be in today, Church of St. Seraphim. Here's Father Adrian. I always find these pictures fascinating, where they're climbing up on a ladder, holding a heavy cross, trying to get it up on the top of the cupola and put it up there. And the people that are down, they're singing, Spasi Gospodi, Ljudi Tvoja, probably so that this poor person doesn't fall and hurt himself. So in context, when you see it happening for real, you understand why the prayer is there. I like this picture too. It's one of the early burials with the snow falling. Kind of reminds you of Russia. And I think that's one of the reasons why they really liked this area and why they settled down here, was the climate and the land and the appearance. It gave them a feeling of, because they were all homesick. They didn't want to leave Russia. They loved Russia. They were very patriotic, but they couldn't stay. And the reason they couldn't stay was because they weren't allowed to practice their faith. And to go back would mean martyrdom. And well, you know, martyrdom is a good thing, but at the same time, you still need to help people, you need to help others. And Vladika and Andrei chose that path, especially in his word for when he became a bishop. He mentions the fact that he felt a terrible responsibility in 1937 when so many priests were sent to execution, and he was not. He felt a responsibility to take care of all the people that were left. He felt that that was a charge that God had given him, and he took that responsibility very seriously. Here he was shown as a bishop. Here, Vladika Filaret, the Metropolitan Filaret, is congratulating him on his 80th birthday. He was reinstated as an archbishop, and that was in 1973, became a bishop in 1968. And Father Seraphim also tragically reposed to the Lord in 1971. His health was a little frail, and as he finished his life's work, the Law of God book, he had a massive heart attack and passed away at the age of, I believe it was 56. So he was very young for a priest. The Nyack parishioners really missed him, but the Lord knows what he's doing, and everybody passes when they're supposed to. So his matushka, which we all call matushka Yolochka, I'm not really sure why she was called Yolochka. We always thought it was because she put on the Yolka plays in Nyack, but I think that was just a nickname they had for her. And so her name was Yelena Alexeyevna, but everybody called her Tyotya Yolochka. And she always ran the preschool class, the kindergarten class. We have students of hers in here in this room at this moment. Not all of them as old as me. So she continued Father Seraphim's work. Here we have a picture that really doesn't have anything to do with the, it's Nova Deveva. It's a service at Nova Deveva in the early 1960s, mid-1960s. Doesn't have anything to do with the lecture other than the fact that that little guy right there, that's me. That's my mom, that's my dad, and my sister is somewhere down here on the floor. My older sister, so. This is an interesting quote. This is the Dmitry Vladimirovich Myshetsky. We were afraid to lose our last chance to escape westward. And they admit that the Germans were worse, but they allowed you to pray to God. And that was the big difference for them. And it's a very good lesson, I think, for all of us.
Thank you for listening to this special podcast of the Eastern American Diocese. Please visit us on the web at www.eadiocese.org. Thank you, and God bless you.